Every Thursday at 8 on heritageradionetwork.com, a continuing conversation about the culture of architecture in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, biases, ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I am Curtis B. Wayne, your host. This evening's sponsor is TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. And did you know they have a pro audio shop? This evening in studio, our guests are Steve Smith from Steve Smith Consulting. Hello, Steve.
Good evening.
Well, let's just start out. Give everybody your URL because they will want to check out what you've got to offer.
Okay, it's ssmithconsulting.com.
Very good. We'll get more into what you bring to the profession. Also joining us is Jamie M. Waugh.
Hello.
Who has been on this program before. Jamie has written about architecture and design for Dwell Magazine. Presently, she is now writing all of the corporate communication and some ad copy for my favorite shirt company. Listen to that. High thread count, Brooks Brothers. Welcome. And joining us as the guest interlocutor is our own host from heritageradionetwork.com, the host, co-host of The Main Course and The Main Course Part Q, Katie Kiefer.
Good evening.
Come a little closer. I can't hear you.
It's kind of hard. My chair is sort of like a bucket, and I've sunk to the bottom of it.
I want you to know that we have only the most plush and comfortable chairs here at Studio A, Heritage Radio Network.
The best repurposed shipping container can offer.
That's right. Here at Roberta's, which those of you who are listening from the greater metropolitan New York area must go out and have a look at Edible Brooklyn, because Roberta's has now hit the main time from Slacker Pizzeria, stumbling into greatness. Wonderful article, photographs, and some bios on the people who make Roberta's possible and makes it the fantasy land of food fun. And we're sitting here looking through the studio windows at a fire pit, and it's a beautiful, beautiful October evening. But let's get into the topic of discussion this evening. In search of a commission, marketing, advertising, and sheer hucksterism, all of which I have encountered in our profession. I want to read a little bit just to start us off from a really wonderful book that is more or less forgotten these days. I discovered this book. If you go back through the archives and look at the program White Rabbit, Tales of Architects and Architecture, I found this book on the bookshelf of Thomas G. Smith in his studio in Rumson, New Jersey, and 1974. It's called This Business of Architecture, written by Royal Barry Wills, who was very known in his time from the early 1930s until he died in 1962. And his son, who is really apparently up in years also, who joined the firm in 1952, carries on as Royal Barry Wills Associates. And Royal Barry Wills was known for being the proponent, the number one popularizer of the New England Cape Cod cottage. And in fact, he even vied with Frank Lloyd Wright for who was more popular in a competition in Life magazine in 1946.
Yeah, but when push came to shove, who really, whose legacy has really, it'd be hard to say whose legacy had really stayed with the common culture. Was it Frank Lloyd Wright's houses, or were it the ubiquitous Cape House, which is in every real estate description, in every real estate
absolutely,
ad circular?
Absolutely, but who remembers Royal Barry Wills, who actually, in this competition in Life magazine, won out over Frank Lloyd Wright in terms of owner satisfaction, after which Wright then put into his official memoirs that one should never enter a competition. this business of architecture, which if you're looking for it, it was very difficult for me to obtain this copy. I had to go to a arcane antique bookseller in Manhattan for this. It was published in 1941 by Reinhold Publishing. Are they even in business anymore?
No, they're long gone.
And we're going to read just a little bit from chapter, let's see, chapter 3, Stalking and Capture of Clients. What Mr. Wills had to say.
I like the concept.
Yeah,
and what listeners will not know, but what we can see in the book is these hilarious little cartoons which illustrate each chapter, and sometimes even are within each chapter.
Sure, here's one of his little cartoons,
yeah,
Stalking and Capture of the Client, and here's a fellow with a deer stalker cap, and he has a hound, and they're going through the woods.
Yeah, unbelievably hokey. This was publishing though in the 40s and 50s. This is what people did. Every book, no matter how serious, apparently, or how frivolous, had these illustrations to kind of keep the reader going even through the driest of tomes. I mean, we were looking at another book that was published in the early 50s called The Betty Cornell Guide to Teenage Popularity.
Which was actually written not by Betty Cornell, but
it was written by Betsy Kiefer, but
Katie's mother.
But the thing that just blew our minds were these hilarious cartoons of the well-groomed girl.
We have that at Brooks Brothers for Gentlemen, How to Raise Young Gentlemen.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's contemporaneous? Contemporary?
It's timeless. No, it's not. I guess it's old fashioned in the sense that it's old fashioned values, don't speak out of turn, open the door for a lady. But it's also the sort of thing that never really goes out of style that people always do sort of appreciate.
Some people do.
Yeah, unless you're Susan Faludi in 1975.
Now, this is what. This is.
Just saying.
This is how Mr. Wills started out his conversation with the reader about the getting of architecture commissions. It says that by nature, the architect does not choose to dissipate his or her energy in the continual struggle of job getting that is forced by circumstances quite beyond his individual control, like as we find these days. He must seldom relinquish the tasks. And then he goes on to say that there are two main groups of potential clients. Class A, those who will eventually employ an architect and have only the matter of selection before them. And Class B, who seem to be the people that I've been pursuing all my life. Those who are ignorant of their need for an architect's services. Prospective building owners who know only vaguely of your existence and nothing of your capabilities, or those who have an erroneous idea about what the value of an architect's services actually are. And goes on to list indirect selling, because in those days it was considered unethical to just take out a straightaway advertisement or advertisement.
Was it unethical or was it simply unseemly?
No, the AIA, the American Institute of Architects, had proscriptions against advertising.
No kidding.
Now, these days, you might be listening to NPR in the drive time hour and hear that this program is brought to you by Helmuth Obata Kassebaum, or HOK, because they do advertise. But so he has a whole list of things that might be done. Temporary exhibits, say, in an abandoned storefront, because this is written right after the Depression, and there were a lot of abandoned storefronts.
As there are now.
Yes, there are now. Newspaper and magazine articles on the practical and economic phases of building, regular appearances of sketches and other renderings in newspapers. Harry Weiss in Chicago excelled at this. He would call a press conference and then give up some sketches of a new marina that he had designed for the Chicago waterfront. And no one had asked him, but because he had been around a while, he could get somebody to show up.
So are we going to be seeing your sketches for the Brooklyn Velodrome?
Very soon. Thank you for asking so much. And we'll talk. We can talk about the Brooklyn Velodrome.
Shameless promotion here.
And the Brooklyn Cycling League, which was not your usual Peloton, I can assure you. Sequence of articles and outlines talking about how, you know, why you should have an architect inspecting your work. Sketch plans that you would leave, say, in your dentist's office.
No kidding. Sketched plans in your dentist's office.
Yeah, in a folio that people could just look at instead of looking at Life magazine or...
Or Look. Or Time or McCall's.
Yeah, yeah, here's the work of Curtis B. Wayne.
Here's a dream house. So instead of House and Garden, I guess the Shelter magazines weren't such a big deal then.
Right. Mm-hmm. Illustrated lectures... movies, dramatizing your previous work that you might get placed in your local movie theater as a short before the main film. Competitions, civic service.
Never mind what Frank Lloyd Wright said about those.
That's right. Civic service in, say, an art commission or a planning commission. Real estate brokers, recommendations. Andy, going to church more often than Easter and Christmas. Getting your name in print for any worthy reason whatsoever.
Wait, going back, going to church more often than
Easter and Christmas.
Christmas.
Yes.
In other words, the congregation was a good source for clients.
Especially, of course, this is written 68 years ago, especially if you have a wife who's social.
Yeah.
Things haven't changed.
Well, in many ways, they haven't, have they?
you're acting shocked.
And then there's an adjunct to that, regulated social activity. Not wasted in the charming company of your own competitors. In other words, social activity, not hanging out with other architects. Hanging out with interesting young people at Roberta's, for example. You never know.
Might lead to something like
the Brooklyn Velodrome.
Right.
Never avoiding a friendly conversation with an apparently solvent person. Even though he be a stranger.
Very important at this point in time.
Yes.
I bet commuting is on that list. Because after all, where are you going to find more solvent strangers than on that commute between New York and Greenwich?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. And he ends up with giving periodic radio chats, an untested but interesting gambit. Sometime in the future, and he leaves it at that, because who's going to tune in to WARCH when they're competing with professional jokesters and Bible-thumping gospel readers? But now we have Heritage Radio Network. Steve has got something to say.
Well, I was just going to say that. It sounds to me like an early version of social media, which we're all facing right now.
That's right. But as I frame all of this, this is like running for Congress, and to a certain extent, and he does talk about this necessity, in because this is all about professional practice. You have to be, to a certain extent, a good politician. Shake a lot of hands. Let's have a little musical interlude right now.
Just show you what my
Thank you, Eric, Jack, Ginger. That was Politician by Cream. I support the left, but I'm leaning to the right. Well, you know, architecturally, I don't know what that means here on Burning Down the House. Jack Inslee is our engineer. E.J. Dukoski is our producer, and we're brought to you by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. So, Steve, Jamie, what say you to, you know, it's like politics. It's like running for Congress. Don't you? I mean, often it feels like I should just stand on the train platform and just introduce myself and give out cards. Would you like a house renovation?
Well, it's true. I mean, one thing we were talking about during the break is architecture. Like a lot of creative endeavors, you are tempted and compelled to sit in front of a computer screen all day long in your house and just work and work and work. And, you know, if you're doing that, you're not going to get clients. But
sometimes we're lucky enough to actually have an office, but okay.
Right, right.
But you, are you doing freelance there for Brooks, or are you in the office?
I am doing freelance, but it's in the office. But when I was working as Dwell's New York editor for the website, and when I was also running the International Design Awards, a competition for architecture, I noticed a lot of ways that architects and designers were really doing innovative things to get people interested in their work. I mean, one really notable way that seems very successful is a few architects I've seen have actually invested a lot of money in their own homes. And then what they do, so they build, you know, they invest in their firm and their home, and then they use their home as sort of a showcase for events that are sponsored by corporations, for example. They bring in journalists, they bring in people in the neighborhood, like you're saying, people who are solvent. You know, they bring in people who might be able to afford their services and just entertain everyone. And that way people are able to, in a way, sample, if you will, the product.
Well, I'm just thinking that along the line of getting visibility, which is what it's all about right now, there are a lot of design competitions that firms tend to get involved in, if nothing else, and so that people know who and what they are and that they, in fact, exist. I think the days of doing some trade shows, it's questionable as to whether they're out or not. There's, you know, school's not out on that thought yet, because if you're there, it doesn't necessarily help you.
You know, I would put a spike through the heart of that one. I was in a consulting business, and we did third-party reviews on behalf of lenders, reviews of prospective real estate developments, and they went, and they still do, went to a lot of trade events, so the Mortgage Bankers of America, people who would be naturally their clients, Real Estate Board of New York, Real Estate Lenders of New York. And yes, everyone knew them, but it really came down to personal that they were at the event. They might have collected a few cards, but that cost them a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And it didn't turn into someone saying, "Oh, you're the person I've been looking for all these years." Love at first sight doesn't seem to happen in a trade show exhibit like Build Boston or something like that. Architects go there and they put up booths, and
I
can't imagine that that's particularly.
Well, Steve, you're in the business of marketing, so what's your magic bullet?
I find that attending things like Society for Marketing Professional Services, where you're networking with similar people who are involved in marketing and business development for the major players and the minor players as well in the architectural community, is a good thing. New York Building Congress, you start rubbing elbows with the players who are the principals of firms. So you're getting to see the upper echelon of organizations as well as players who are in the position to get you projects. And the name of the game is to let people know who and what you are and what your capabilities are and what your strengths are, and then to connect with the different firms that are out there. It's all about being in as many places you possibly can if you're a business development person. And in the marketplace right now, people get confused.
But not amongst your architectural competitors, amongst other people who are related or allied.
Well, if you're going for a prime position, correct. If you're going for a teaming opportunity, which is pretty typical, then sure, you want to see some of the players there. If you're an architect, you're looking for an MEP. If you're an architect, you might be looking for civil. So there are a lot of reasons why you get together.
What is MEP and what is civil?
Okay, MEP being mechanical, electrical, and plumbing engineering, which is a different discipline, but usually part of the team scenario.
Major part of the team.
Major. All the buildings go up. You have HVAC, and you have all the other electrical that goes into the building. So certainly you need to have people who are knowledgeable in that area, which architects usually defer to. Where do you meet those people? Well, you meet them at events that are showcased by, as I said, SMPS, New York Building Congress, and AIA New York Chapter. Certainly, probably one of the most, the strongest drawing card out there is Heritage Ball, which everybody puts on their black tie and gowns and goes to this annual event, has a great time, and gets to meet all the players.
Whose ball is that?
That's AIA New York Chapters.
Oh, yes, the Center for Architecture Ball.
Correct.
That's the dress-up one.
That's the one where you get pretty and go out and look
nice. The dress-down one is the Beaux-Arts Ball now through the Architectural League, and people now go in T-shirts and because it's young people who belong to the Architectural League.
But that's no fun. Well, here's what you do.
Well, it's no fun for us.
Well, let me just clarify that. You can go to the 9 o'clock event, which takes place at AIA headquarters at the chapter, at the center, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. And that's where the party really happens. So between 9 and 2 in the morning, that's where the young folk in the industry show up, and without tuxedos. You go there in your jeans, and you have a great time.
Did you go to this year's Heritage Ball?
I wish you didn't ask me that.
However, no. You need to. Is that why, Steve?
That's exactly
you're so
why.
Incredibly successful.
Thank you.
That there's no need for you to attend these events because you have more clients than you can possibly
now, Steve, manage.
But you can always take a few more.
Let's get into a little bit of shameless hucksterism on your behalf. You've made presentations on behalf of the Brick Institute of America.
Yes.
And you've been involved in the importation of elevator components from Europe into the United States.
That is correct.
And you have touched almost every aspect of the construction and design world, which stands in good stead for you as a representative of architectural firms.
Well, yes, it's. Thank you for pointing that out. It's always an uphill battle when you're bringing new products and new technology into the marketplace. And I would say right now the newest technology on the plate is building information modeling. And that
BIM.
Goes BIM, right, the acronym. And that, I think, plays into the how are architects in the future going to relate to each other? Because now all of a sudden they're all going to have to work together. Different disciplines are going to have to interface through the vehicle of BIM, whatever it is, on the structural side, on the engineering
side. Yes, because one of the aspects of BIM is that you can't put an element into the drawing without knowing its CSI specification section and what it can do, what are its materials.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it's supposed to work. You can't draw a wall without knowing how it's constructed, theoretically.
Right.
Then there's a whole other world of information that comes in through the internet that gets plugged into these models, which has not been vetted. And that's where I come in, because the stuff that's on the internet is not coordinated, and the people, the individual vendors who are telling you, well, here's our product, and this is how it goes together with another assembly. Case in point, Conair, the curtain wall and skylight company, will show you details of how the end bits, the edges of their skylight or curtain wall fits in with, say, the concrete frame of the building. And they'll schematically show a little backer rod and some caulk. And I've had fairly senior designers in large firms take that detail and insist that it is right because Conair did it, and I have to explain to them. Conair is showing you a Conair curtain wall, but the caulking, flashing, which isn't even shown in the detail, and fastening aspects of it have not been vetted because Conair is not in the caulking and flashing business. You have to understand the caulking and the flashing. Now, the BIA, the Brick Institute of America, gives you a lot of information about brick and how it should be flashed. They are exemplary. They're a fabulous source. But let's just step back now to the bigger world of marketing. You can market design, or you can market technical prowess. You can pretend that you're a very large firm until you fake it till you make it. I know several firms that have built themselves up by acquiring other firms, and they got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then in the end, they are selling across-the-board expertise, when in fact, they may not have integrated that expertise. So, do you find that it's easier to sell design or technical prowess, or neither, or what's your feeling about that?
I think it's a very interesting question at this juncture of the technology. I believe that there's a lot of design work being done that is unique and different, and it's come about because of the rapid change and improvement in, shall we say, glass curtain wall. The quality of it, I mean, brick is 9,000 years old, and things like glass curtain wall, when they first came out, may be problematic. But that has since changed, perhaps, and there's a lot of creativity on behalf of the architects who can come to the table and twist and bend and apply different tensions to the glass wall now that is very unique and personally quite appealing. Having said that, there's also something, getting back to BIM, where suddenly you need to know about the technology so you can be a player and interface with all the other users of this technology, building information modeling, whether it's ARCHICAD or Teclo or some of the other great products that are out there. You suddenly can design beauty, but you can do it from a technical perspective before you put shovels in the ground. And that's the key to the whole thing right now.
Yeah, we were talking about that with the Sharpless brothers from Shop Architects, about building it twice virtually and taking responsibility for knowing how it goes together before you even issue the drawings.
Yeah, well, I think Shop has kind of entered the realm of Starkitect because of how they were recently put on the position.
You know, they hate that word, though.
Well, it's out there, and they were connected with it.
You say that around them, and they rip their shirts and say, no, 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 we're not stars. We're a group working together. There is no star here. There are five or seven principals, and we're doing it together. So let's not call them Starkitects at this point because we don't want to offend them. They're friends of the show. Yeah. But I truly do believe that they are onto the, let's be grand here, the salvation of our profession, because we all agree, I and a few other like-minded people that I'm aware of, believe that we are now ready to reclaim mastery of the building process.
Hear, hear.
No, but that is not the cell that has existed for the last, 35 years. Mm-hmm. I spoke for an hour, more or less, about the white architects, the New York Five, a few weeks ago. And they were selling purity of design. How it got put together did not interest them all that much. Now, we've come through that, and now we have our star architects. We are stuck here. We have Frank Gehry. We have Tom Main of Morphosis. We have Rem Koolhaas. These are design-oriented guys, and they're selling the big image thing. I doubt they ever walk a project to see that it's actually being built in a way that is firm, sound, and leading to the convenience factor. In our very first program, we talked about Venustas, Comitatus, and Firmitas. And we all said, well, okay, there are these great designs, but what happened to Delight? What happened to Venustas? And I think that is a result of architects not taking responsibility for the entire world. Now, if you, Steve, or
Curtis, dare I say that you have a bias as a materials guy? I don't know.
No. You see, the new masters of architecture.
Tell us.
will return to the world of being master builders. We're not old masters. We are the new masters. We take responsibility for knowing and caring about all aspects of the built environment, not just being building decorators. But that has been a difficult proposition to sell to the big picture committees who tend to make the decisions, like the committee that made the decision to hire Tom Main to do 41 Cooper Square, which we've spoken at great length on this program about, and we'll probably continue to speak about from time to time until some great benefactor gives them $100 million to tear it down and replace it with a beautiful building. But aside from my own bias
That's
towards
right, honey,
make ugliness,
friends and influence people.
You know,
just the big guy. Why not?
Well, there'll be other big guys.
I would love to say that I invited him to come on the program, but when I met him, he was having his day of glory, and I did not want to pee in the punch.
But Curtis, I have a question for you. So,
yes.
Do you not think that Gary and Meyer can actually, you know, draw a blueprint that would sustain itself mathematically? I mean, do you,
they themselves?
Yeah. I mean, do you honestly think that because they build pretty buildings, they don't know how to draw?
It's not the drawing. It's not the drawing. It's the only architect.
Constructability.
The only star architect that I knew of who could not draw was Philip Johnson, and Philip's gone on to his great reward. And he would be the first to admit that he could not draw, but he had interesting ideas. On the other hand, he also said, let someone else worry about the roof details, and all of his roofs leaked, almost without exception. It was someone else's problem to figure out how the toilets all flushed. And to a certain extent, he's right, because some of these are commodity engineering services. Yet, when it comes to crafting the enclosure of a building, whether it leaks, whether it lets air through, how it keeps out the sun. These are all good aspects of the advent of mindset of being green, being sustainable, conforming to LEED, and so forth. But now, both of you have written or promoted, have architectural and design firms. What have you found that, to get back to Vox Populi's question, what works? Do you have silver bullets? What works? What has worked?
Well, one of the things that I think is plaguing our industry, when I ask architects, do you design using brick? They say, no, the commission came in requesting glass. So I said, what would you prefer to do it in? And their feeling is, we'll do it in whatever the developer wants, whatever the owner wants. So the question in my mind is, what's driving some of the design work right now? And I think a piece of marketing is your last project. How good was it? And the question that you raise about forensics is a very valid question, because we don't know.
No. Forensics is when the building is dead.
Yeah, and there might be a few glass curtain wall buildings in the future where we might see this, because there haven't been enough up long enough to really know the durability of these type of projects.
Stop being brick man for a moment and
no, I'm realist
and relax, because I have found in my own experience that the glass people, out of necessity, have taken a far more proactive role in allowing architects to specify their products post John Hancock Building.
Granted,
in Boston,
right,
where PPG said, fine, you want us to make you a 10-foot high by 7-foot wide piece of glass, insulated. We've never done it before, but by golly, no problem. Here it is. And no one really tested these units.
That's right. With
the wind loads and the mm-hmm. thermal loads, and they all shattered, and the Hancock Building became the world's tallest plywood-clad skyscraper.
Exactly right.
But, so when you're marketing a firm, Steve, if you're going to market Wayne Architects of Greenwich, Connecticut, which ceased operation 8.5 years ago, we were a niche player, and I was able to fairly successfully sell our services because we did retail banking.
Mm-hmm.
by talking to the fact that I'd worked in financial institutions. I understood the time constraints, the financial constraints, and I also understood the operational aspects of the specific types of buildings that I was willing to design for them. In other firms, say we were talking about Canon Design, if you were going to be promoting them, because they're an Upper Great Lakes architectural firm with a national presence, how would you market them?
Well, you know, you usually target their strengths, where they have a whole repertoire of projects that they've done that are related to the scope of work for the project that in hand that you're looking at. So if there's an RFP, request for proposal, that's out there, and it's calling for someone who has healthcare capabilities, then you certainly would look for a firm that you want to market that has that in their collection of projects they've done very successfully and have teamed with excellent firms. And then you go ahead and do that again. So Wayne Architecture, with the banking capabilities you've had in the past, I would be with the first person to say, give me your cut sheets on projects you've done related to retail banks and give me a bio, and we'll either be a subcontractor to someone who wants to be prime, or we'll go after this request for a proposal in a very serious way, put together some really wonderful data about your capabilities, and do a submittal. And you have to do that in a very close and tight time frame.
Of course. Now, all of you who are listening out there saying, oh, retail banks, I hadn't thought about that. Forget about it. When the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed, that was a law passed at the midst of the last Great Depression that forbade banks from here to ever after being in the same business organization with an investment bank. No mixing up of retail banking with investment banking or investments. When that was repealed, the money flew into retail banks who started selling mutual funds and then started selling you stocks and stock portfolios, and that got us to credit default swap products and hedge funds and 11% unemployment. And so the retail banks are no longer putting money into brick-and-mortar retail branches. Also, there's been a concatenation of the retail banking industry because big banks swallowed smaller banks until there are many fewer. 10 years ago, there were 10,000 retail banks in the United States. That number's down to about 4,000. So it's a nice niche, but we can't plow those fields anymore. They've been salted. Thanks. All you guys who are advising the president made that policy to repeal it. Smartest guys in the room.
But they just killed legislation to try to reinstate that.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful?
Yeah,
thank you.
But to go back to the marketing aspect.
Marketing. To a certain extent.
What you're talking about, but Steve, what you just described to me is basically a pitch. It's a sales pitch. And what I think, what I'm interested in hearing is like the overall sort of how you market a firm in the greater scheme, not going after a specific job, but just the sort of general raising the profile, the public profile of a company so that they are visible within a specific niche in the greater the greater field.
What Royal Barry Wills would call indirect promotion.
Right.
Yeah, well, with in the past, what we've done for marketing, and let's differentiate marketing from business development, which is actually getting the business relationship going and then turning it over to perhaps a principal of a firm and letting them close the deal. That's not what we're talking about here in marketing, and I can't tell you how often I see confusion between marketing. We want a strong marketing person who can do business development. Well, then you want a business development person. The marketing piece
is... That's a very good point. I've been in so many firms where they said, we need marketing. And then you as a marketing person comes in and you say, well, you know, we need better slides of your past projects so that I can show it around to, you know, clouds of possible clients.
Or I can work in with your PR firm to develop your collaterals.
Yeah. And then they say, no, we want you to get us leads. And that's a different thing.
You're onto a very important aspect, because it's a matter of whether the principals, number one, understand the difference between marketing and business development, and how much they support either one of those. Now, in this marketplace that we're facing right now, we see a lot of firms that weren't giving a lot of credence to business development or marketing, had lots of projects, they all went on hold, now all of a sudden they're, where are we going to get our next project? Yeah. Where that's not going to be on hold. Who's got cash? And suddenly they're saying, well, let's go out and do business development. That's important, but it's got to be done hand in hand with the marketing profile. And getting back to the question about marketing, my view of it is that you have to have visibility, you have to have collateral materials, you have to have a good website, so when you leave a meeting or a trade show, someone's got a place to go to find out what you're all about, because what do people retain when they talk to you? 20% of your conversation?
Yeah, they're lucky if they took your card. Yeah.
That's right. Having said that...
Is Jamie nodding her head no or yes?
No, I agree with you. But also I think that it's... what I've seen in residential architecture, the most successful architects are the ones who do pretty much two really, really basic things. One, they'll build a really good building. They'll build a really lovely house. And two, they get to know the friends of the people who own the house that they built. And so these architects, it's not a matter of creating, it's not a matter of answering RFPs, submitting, RFPs, whatever. It's just a matter of building a good house, getting people to know about it, getting people into it, and then getting people to want to hire you. And that last part also has to do with your own personality and your ability to sort of work with that client. And it sounds really basic, but I think that a lot of professionals don't. It's tough for them to do that. It's if at any one of those steps.
Okay, now I'm gonna I want to blue sky for just a moment. Supposing you were. I'm reminded of the story of Bernardo Fort Brescia, one of the two founders of Arquitectonica in Miami. And Bernardo apparently was, at age 28, a totally driven salesman. And he found out that Harry Helmsley was coming to Miami. And he found out where Harry was staying. And he just invited himself in to talk to Harry Helmsley and talked him into hiring Arquitectonica to do an apartment house, just on the sheer force of his personality.
Sounds like Charlie Sheen in Wall Street.
Yeah, and enthusiasm. That's right. I know this person's going to buy. Yeah. Go sell him.
Yeah.
Now, he did that, and this is something of architectural lore, and apparently it's true. Certainly, it's true. It's part of the lore of architecture. Now, supposing that you were an architect and you would want to say do a project for the related companies, and they still have money. What if you just found a couple of people who on the roster and just invited yourself to go and drop in and leave your card with some material for them and followed up with some phone calls? I don't think that... my feeling is, in these days, if they like what they see and they didn't know about you, they might actually talk to you.
Absolutely the right approach. Because, a top-down approach can always have a degree of success. If you're a project manager and the principal of the firm or an owner and developer hands his architect a card, sure, he's going to do business with that firm because he feels that it's recognition from the higher-ups, the C-level people, that this is exactly...
I just had a great idea. Steve, you and I should put together a list of all the developers that we know that still have some access to capital and sell that list to the architectural community with names and phone numbers.
This is like a Bloomberg effect. Okay.
Yeah, it's like Millennium
Worked
related, Extel.
Extel.
I have Joe Moynihan's email address. Okay. I know Ken Swig. Ken's kind of liking the flusher right now, but he'll come out of it.
It's not a bad idea.
No, I'm keeping that list for myself. Thank
you. Now that we all know about it, thank you.
So we've talked about ways to put up some kites to see if anybody listens. Let's hear our next little musical break and take a breather.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there, late of Pablo Frank is there, what a scene. Over men and horses, hoops and garters, lastly through a hogshead of real fire. In this way, Mr. K will challenge the world. The celebrated Mr. K performs his feat on Saturday at Bishop's Gate. The Hendersons will dance and sing as Mr. Kite flies through the ring. Don't be late. Let his K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances the waltz. Mr. K performs his tricks without a sound. And Mr. H will demonstrate 10 somersets he'll undertake on solid ground. Ding ding, some days in preparation, a splendid time is guaranteed for all. And tonight, Mr. Kite is topping the bill.
In a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. By a fountain, her rocking horse people eat marshmallow pies. Everyone smiles as you drift past the flowers that grow so incredibly high.
Sorry.
He screams a lot at home, right? He has his headphones on and screams.
Oh, yeah.
Go, what are you yelling at?
I'm always burning down the house here every Thursday on heritageradio.com. heritageradionetwork.com.
Thank you.
Brought to you by TechServe. Thank you so much. Well, a couple of the, you know, the out there Beatles songs kind of described to me the skitsy. We wish we could afford those really groovy drugs right now because we need them. These are hard times for architects. The ones who have jobs say, man, I have no life because they're working 50-hour weeks mandatory at 10% less salary with incredible tension.
They'd be happy if it was only 10% less.
Some are more.
You know more than that, Steve?
Well, you know, the prices have been slashed, and the question is, will they ever be able to get the prices back up to where they really need to be to make a reasonable living for the services they provide, the education that they have under their belt? It's a big question mark.
Well, not that we want competition, but the new masters take more responsibility and are willing to take back a bigger piece of the pie, which leads to some wrangles with the construction managers who have successfully disintermediated us from figuring out how to build the thing. Now, if we figured it out before that, they have less to do, so their fee is going to go back from, say, 4% to 2% or less. Maybe we'll get back to architects and general contractors and let the construction managers come work for us.
Well, that would be interesting. I think the industry is headed in the other direction because now with LEED certification, all of a sudden you've got a new breed, a new discipline out there that's being added to the fracas.
Well, you know, LEED AP, really, that's kind of like being a Rastafarian or a Scientologist from my point of view. We talk about this frequently. I have enough paper. I'm an architect. That should be the highest degree of paper on my wall.
Agreed.
You'd enjoy talking with Gennaro Brooks Church, who's been here a couple of times. He is a self-professed professional test taker. And he said for him it was just a matter of memorization. Take the test, and when it came down to it, it wasn't anything that he, as a builder, didn't already know.
That is correct. And that every architect should know as well.
Every architect should know that. And, of course, the point of continuing education that many states, including New York, have instituted is to encourage architects to continue to be intellectually curious, which if you're not intellectually curious, I have to say, well, what are you doing in architecture anyway? Because you must always continue to research, travel, inquire. If you're not naturally curious, your work is going to suffer, and no legal act is going to enforce that. And besides which, not that I want to denigrate the seminars that I've had from people from the Brick Institute of America. I've learned a great amount over the years from people who came out to talk to us about brick and flashing and control joints and all of those good things that keep building from becoming a disaster.
Right.
But most of the continuing education classes that I have taken, I could have taught myself. And that's a sad thing. I want to learn new things.
Well, hopefully one of the new things that you can learn is has to do with some of the training that I did this past summer at AIA New York chapter at the center, which was geared towards their program, not business as usual, quote unquote, geared towards the unfortunate architects who were looking for opportunities and no longer with the firms they were previously with. And the whole program was to teach them how to use some of the new technologies like ArchiCAD so that they can become up to speed and work a little smarter and get educated.
Sure.
There's a lot of programs going on there now at AIA that are really helpful towards retraining people, if you will, in their own profession, though. So I think a piece of it that you're talking about is the technology.
Are they paying you to say this? Indirectly.
They're paying me in kind. No. No.
No, but I mean, this is part of what helps you market a firm is by demonstrating to a prospective purchaser of those services that the people that you're representing or that you're showing the portfolio of are people who have all of that stuff right under their belt and right at their fingertips and know exactly what they're talking about,
yeah.
as opposed to somebody who's kind of dwelling in another decade, mm-hmm. Which I think is probably all too common. I mean, you know, let's face it, curiosity is something of an anomaly these days. I think people get their professional training and they come out of their professional training and they're like ready to do their thing, and then they do their thing and they think that their thing is the thing and that's what they're selling, and they're not, I think, in many cases recognizing that times move on, technology changes, that the way buildings are put together changes probably from month to month, if not at least year to year. And if you don't stay up with those changes, it's kind of like doctors not staying up with the latest in pharmaceuticals or in technology or in medical technology.
I think you hit upon a very important aspect, which is that there's an incredible amount of elements and materials that are constantly being modernized, renovated, created, invented, and architects are supposed to know that they're all out there. So the only means by which they can find out what's available to do a building, be it a residential or an unlimited height high-rise, has to do with having continuing ed credits and having firms come in and talk to them about it and let them make the decisions. What type of glass should I use? What type of flashing? Do I use PVC? Do I use something that's a bit more permanent and is going to last longer? There's a whole range of materials out there for putting up today's buildings that we didn't have 20 years ago. So architects have to know so much, which is why their libraries have to be full of data, which means that they constantly have to be trained and educated.
So you're cleaving towards the trend of thinking that what's... you have an admirer out there, Chef?
Sorry.
More than one.
Towards
well, that just stopped things dead tonight.
Yeah, I have to understand that Studio A has a very large,
with a huge picture window looking out onto the
insulated
fire
picture
pit.
Window yeah. that looks out into the garden. There's a fire pit and small children, animals, and occasionally inebriated guests of Roberta's come up and peer in, saying, "What is this?"
Or wave enthusiastically as if they know you very well.
I think they're mistaking us for those windows in Amsterdam.
Oh, yes. I was going to say the windows in Bloomingdale's.
Yeah, well, all right. That's
I can relate to the ones in Amsterdam.
Really, Steve? Tell us more. Do we have much time to
read? But you're trending towards a marketing approach that says that the people that you would represent are up to date on their technology. They're going to produce a sound building, and those old guys who just did fabulous crazy shit. Look, their buildings leak anyway, and the Disney concert hall had to have netting put over it because it was blinding people coming across on the expressway or off the expressway when the sun was in a certain direction.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay,
what I am saying,
you don't want to offend Frank O'Gary.
It is shameful when you have because, to start well, buffing your building down.
Well, that's good because he speaks very well of you.
Oh, very good. Then I'll leave him alone. There's something to be said about having to do something about the reflective capabilities of a building on the condo across the street. So that should have been taken into consideration initially.
Now, who built that?
Well, that was the building you just mentioned. Yeah, the Disney.
The Disney building.
Yeah, yeah, it was frying the people in the residential buildings.
And they had to sand down or sandblast or do something to the building to ensure that it
wouldn't be so bright. Well, let us not speak ill of the... of the elder statesmen of our profession. I think it's come to the time when we have to wrap up. I think that we've determined that there is no silver bullet, but that a bold approach to people who might be in a position to build a project that you would like to design for them, if approached with the proper attitude of enthusiasm, you just never know.
And stay up to date on your certifications. Without a doubt. Stay up to date with your technology.
This has been Burning Down the House here at HeritageRadio.com.
Brought to you. Radio Network.
HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Thanks, Katie.
Every Thursday at 8. Thank you to TechServe.
Thank you to Steve Smith. Thank you to Jamie Waugh.
To Katie Kiefer.
Thank you to Curtis Wayne.
Thank you to Jack Inslee and EJ Dukoski. And we'll talk to you next time.